All right, we have looked at a variety of areas that the Bible receives criticism for, including history and archaeology and science and even the text and how it transmitted down to us to the present day. And here's where we've been so far. We're five lessons in, but we've talked already about the transmission, translation. That's first where the attacks occurred. Does the text even resemble what was originally given? We've dealt with that. Science, does the Bible teach things that are contradictory to science? History and archaeology, what does the ground, the dirt evidence say? Last week we looked at prophecy. And the Bible claims to be, actually is, a third of prophecy. Does what it says is going to happen in the future take place? And we saw many examples where that indeed is the case. But there are some that haven't been fulfilled, and we gave some reasons why that's so as well. So that leads us kind of to a catch-all thing tonight. There's going to be some a unified presentation tonight. It's not just going to be a shotgun, but I needed another lesson because they're just criticisms that are outside the present fields that we've talked about. It's not really a criticism about the text and how it got to us. It's not about science. It's not about history or even what the Bible promises. But suppose contradictions, things that don't line up, numbers and dates, things like that. And so this is kind of the catch-all for common criticisms, recent criticisms that have been made against the Bible. My goal tonight is not to answer every possible criticism, because there are whole websites with hundreds of criticisms launched at the Bible.
It would take
me forever to go through all the possible criticisms. I don't even know that I know them all. I was on the web again today just looking at some of the articles and reading a little bit. I wish I had more time, actually, because I kind of like this stuff. And I'm out of time, so I'm going to give you what I have tonight. But what I really want to show you is a visible pattern that the Bible can be trusted. That there are answers if you look for them. Answers where you don't have to put your head in the sand and say, okay, I'm a Christian, I'm just going to turn my back on that. I don't think you have to do that as a believer. If you earnestly seek information and evidence, there are answers for those who want them. So I'm going to divide the lesson up tonight into three parts, as we've done in previous weeks. Tonight we're going to look at general facts about criticism. Then we're going to look at notable critics and their conclusions. Then we're going to respond to some common criticisms. And again, I can't handle all of them. We're going to look at six major ones. I think it's six, maybe seven major ones before the lesson is through tonight. Let's start with just some general facts about criticism and people making criticisms of the Bible. Very indebted to John Blanchard in his book, Why I Believe the Bible, which is available. It's a little booklet about 40 pages long. It's on the table if you'd like a copy. Who opened up several of these arguments for me that I think are very helpful. The first one is coming up momentarily. There it is. An unanswered question is not the same as proof of a mistake. And these are your first blanks on the outline, by the way. An unanswered question is not the same as proof of a mistake. And an unsolved problem is not necessarily an error. That's a helpful thing. Just because I don't know the answer doesn't mean it's wrong. The second thing he states is, over the last 150 years, patient research has steadily whittled away at alleged errors and discrepancies. 150 years ago, the mid-1800s, was the rise of higher criticism, and many attacks were made against the Bible, that it wasn't written by who the Bible says it was written by, or it wasn't written at the time, the scriptures say. And over the last 150 years, we're finding more and more evidence that lend credence to the original interpretation, the traditional interpretation of those books and their authorship. So time has helped us to gain research to put the criticisms to rest. American theologian R.C. Sproul claims there is less reason today to believe that the Bible is full of contradictions than at any time in the history of the church. A third item about general facts about criticism: it has been accepted for over 2,500 years that, with certain qualifications, the benefit of doubt must be given to the document concerned. I'm going to develop this a little bit more by telling you about a man named Simon Greenleaf, professor at Harvard University. Of course, you can see by the picture we're dealing with a man who's lived more than 100 years ago, but he was the one that came up with a documentary rule And he says, every document apparently ancient, coming from proper repository or custody, and bearing on its face no evident marks of forgery, the law presumes to be genuine and devolves on the opposing party the burden of proving it be otherwise. So instead of being defensive that you don't have all the academic degrees behind your name or haven't spent 100 hours studying the Bible background, when the critic points his finger and says, hey, there's a contradiction, well, prove that it's a contradiction. Put the burden on them instead of on a document that really does demonstrate itself to be from antiquity, not a work of forgery, but one that we can believe. So this is another blank that you need to fill in on your outline there. This documentary rule from Simon Greenleaf, a student of documents from antiquity. All right. Having said those general things about criticism, I'd like to start with some notable critics and what conclusions they've reached. All right. And we're going to start with Simon Greenleaf, who lived and died in 1853, a professor of law at Harvard, expert on legal evidence. He researched the evidence for the resurrection and became a Christian. His book, The Testimony of the Evangelist, records his story and what he believes about the Gospels. He's not the only one. Another man whose book I read, I noticed by my mark here, in July of 2002, Frank Morrison, Who Moved the Stone. He was an attorney who started out. He said, I'm going to put this Bible thing to rest. I'm going to study the New Testament. I'm going to prove that Jesus didn't rise from the grave. That'll settle the question. We can throw the Bible out and I can move on with my life, and so can the rest of the world. Problem, he did the research and came to the conclusion resurrection did happen. He became a born-again believer and a defender of the Bible. And so here's Simon Greenleaf, here's Frank Morrison, and their story can be told more times than I have time to tell you, but other people have made the same journey. They've done the homework, they've done the research, and they've come to the conclusion the Bible, what the Bible says, is so. Here's another critic. From the 1700s, an infidel in France named Voltaire. He predicted the Bible would be gone in 100 years. Instead, he's gone and the Bible goes on. In fact, Geisler and Nix, in their book, you can see this in the footnotes, said that about 75 years, what is 100 years after he was gone, a Bible society was using his house to print Bibles. The irony of it. Time magazine ran an article in December 30, issue 1974, entitled The Bible, the Believer's Gain. Their conclusion, and I'd like to read it in its entirety, only part of it's put there on the screen, but the breadth, sophistication, and diversity of all this biblical investigation are impressive. But it begs the question, has it made the Bible more credible or less? After more than two centuries of facing the heaviest scientific guns that could be brought to bear, the Bible has survived and is perhaps the better for the siege. Even on the critics' own terms, historical fact, the scriptures seem more acceptable now than they did when the rationalists began the attack. He's talking about higher critics and rationalists out of Germany from the mid-1800s. Hey, Time magazine, I wouldn't say, is a friend of fundamentalism or conservative Christianity. And they're stating the fact the Bible is more solid today than it was two centuries ago. There's plenty of fact to base our faith upon. Hey, we could go into to more, but again, I'm trying to stay in a timely fashion. I want to go to the third item where I'm going to spend most of my time tonight, responding to notable criticisms made against the Bible. And I've chosen to group the criticisms. There are other criticisms you're going to see. I have a whole appendix that's 3 pages long with more answers to criticisms. And I just can't go through them all. But I've chosen to deal with the ones that deal with questionable ethics. Because if I can't disprove the Bible by its text, and I can't disprove it because scientifically, and if I can't disprove it historically, then I'm going to make an attack that I don't like the ethics of the Bible. The moral standards seem imbalanced. That's not the right word I'm looking for. They seem to favor Christians at some times, and then they're just incongruent. I'm not coming up with the right word, but they it just doesn't mesh. The ethics of the Bible. So we're going to look at some ethical categories, and I'm actually going to walk down each of these tonight. There are six of them. The subjugation of women, religious intolerance, use of capital punishment, sexual acts like incest, slavery in both the Old Testament and New Testament. And the last question, which is kind of the sell point for the whole lesson, is what do we do with the genocide in the Bible, the supposed elimination of entire races or ethnicities or religions? So we'll deal with that. That'll be our final question tonight. Let's go ahead and walk through these. Actually, before I do the first one, I want to give a general answer to the list that you see on the board. Generally, I would say that finding these things in the Bible enhances my respect for it. If the Bible just smoothed over things over time and everything was politically correct in the Bible, I would think that people had redacted it or changed it over time. The fact that there are elements in the Bible that don't set well with society today lends credence to the fact that it's really the book that it claims to be from God, and it's a book from antiquity. It isn't keeping up with the time. Some churches do this, right? They change their policies, new prophets come out, and suddenly it's no longer bad for African Americans not to be part of the priesthood. They can be part of the priesthood now. 1978, we can change that because we have updated prophets. Now, we don't believe in that, but our Bible doesn't change. We don't have modern-day prophets. That lends credence and credibility. Those are issues that don't really line up with today's thinking and society, and that doesn't fit. And I would say that that's a good thing. It says the Bible doesn't romanticize the behavior of the people therein. As the things were at the time that the Bible was written, so they are recorded. That strengthens the Bible's credibility as a historical document. All right, let's begin with the first one, subjugation of women. And often the Bible is presented as putting down women, but Bible-friendly cultures have shown greater respect for women than other cultures, and all we need to do is you get a picture on the news media from the Middle East today, and you know that there's a great deal more respect for women in cultures that respect the Bible than respect other religious books or other religious teachings. So to say that it presents women in a subjugated light doesn't really mesh with what we know in our own experience today. Now, why is that? Why does the Bible... In fact, Bible-friendly cultures around the world seem to give more respect to women than any other culture. Why is that? Well, I think it has to do with the verse that's coming up on the screen for you now, 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse number 7. Likewise, husbands, dwell with them, we're speaking of wives, according to knowledge, giving honor unto wife as under the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered. I call attention to the phrase, heirs together of the grace of life. They both have an eternal soul. They're both going to be somewhere for eternity, and therefore they have value in the eyes of God, and therefore ought to have value in the eyes of men. Everybody is equal in the eyes of God. And I think that raises respect for women. What about the practice of polygamy? Doesn't that put women down? Maybe you've seen some of the programs on the television, Sister Wives, My Five Wives on the Learning Channel. And, hey, doesn't the Bible mention and even teach polygamy as a way of life? Of course, even some churches have taught that as an acceptable way of life. In fact, the message I mentioned this morning from 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 2, Elkanah had two wives. Hannah is always listed first, and Peninnah follows, suggesting that he married her second because he was not able to have an heir through Hannah. Of course, Solomon takes the cake when it comes to polygamy, right?
Yeah.
Does anyone remember how many wives he had? He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. That's 1,000 women. You have to be a very rich man to control that kind of a harem. That's 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 1 through 3.
He couldn't even give each one of them 8 hours in a day.
What does the Bible really say about polygamy? I want to give you these. It never endorses the practice. It does state it. Solomon did have 700 wives and 300 concubines. Elkanah had two wives. Abraham had more than one wife. It does state the practice, but it doesn't endorse the practice. Just because it states it in the Bible doesn't say that we ought to do it. Satan lied in the Bible, but that doesn't mean we need to lie. Of course, the Bible's against that. All right? It reveals the problems it creates, especially in the example I cited this morning with Hannah and Peninnah. There was some jealousy and some bitterness back and forth because one was able to have children and the other wasn't. You might remember the tension between Rachel and Leah because Leah was able to bear four children and Rachel couldn't bear any. And the dispute over that. And one time Rachel says, you know, Leah asked for the son's mandrakes and trade for Jacob that particular evening. So some family feuding is revealed in that practice. It also prohibits the practice for king. Solomon must have missed that in Deuteronomy chapter 17. There are actually three things that a king was not supposed to multiply to himself if he was an Israelite king. He wasn't supposed to multiply horses. He wasn't dependent on an army. He was dependent on God. He wasn't supposed to multiply silver and gold. He was to have his riches in the Lord. And the third thing is he wasn't supposed to multiply wives to himself. It was prohibited for kings. Solomon missed it. So this is what the Bible does say about polygamy. It's not endorsing it, but it does mention it. Another problem when it comes to women in the Bible has to do with submission. President Jimmy Carter probably takes the cake on this one. I believe the Bible except the parts that speak of the subjection of women. You might know that he was, I believe, an ordained minister in the Southern Baptist Convention. And in 2000, 15 years ago, he severed ties with the Southern Baptist Convention, citing this issue, its position on the submission of women. It is true that women were submissive and obedient to their husbands in the Scriptures, but that does not mean that they were treated like chattel or property. Chattel is another word for property. Let me give you some... I missed a slide. It didn't get in there. I'll have to give these verses to you this way. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1. Likewise, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not in the word, they also may without the word be won by the conversation of the wives. So Peter instructs wives to be submissive even to unbelieving, disobedient husbands who don't know the Lord. Then 1 Corinthians 11:3, but I would have you know that the head of every man is Christ, the head of woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God. So there is a divine order in the Trinity that Paul cites in 1 Corinthians 11, and he cites that's the reason for the order in the home. So I've set it out this way. In the Trinity, God the Father comes first, and in the home, the husband takes the lead. In the Trinity, the Son reports to His Father. 1 Corinthians 15:28 says that the Son will put all things in subjection to the Father at His feet. Well, the wife reports to her husband, and she is subject to, puts everything under his feet and leadership in the home. And then the Holy Spirit in the New Testament came from the Father and the Son. He proceeds. In fact, theologians call it the procession of the Spirit because he comes from the Father and the Son. Interestingly, from the home, the husband and wife come, the children proceed. Now, no one would say in the Trinity, because the Son puts everything at the feet of the Father, that the Son is less than the Father, or that the Holy Spirit is less than the Father. It's a divine order. It's not a statement about equality. I believe Jesus Christ is equal with God, that He is God in human flesh. And so when we put an order in the home, we're not stating that it's an order of equality. It's an order of function. In fact, I think I have that in the notes. That it's an order of a functional statement of order. The feminist movement today has a hard time distinguishing the two, order and equality. And that has led to a lot of unnecessary criticism against the Bible, subjugation of women. I'm going to leave that subject. I'm going to go on. Does the Bible teach religious intolerance? You might remember Elijah and the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, 1 Kings chapter 18. There's a big showdown. Fire falls out of heaven on one altar. That's Elijah's, not on the Baal altar. And then as a result, Elijah goes after the prophets of Baal, 400 prophets of Baal, 450 prophets of Ashtaroth, and kills them by the brook Kidron. Verse 40, Elijah said unto them, take the prophets of Baal, let none of them escape. And they took them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon, and he slew them there. Oh, wow. See, the Bible's intolerant, doesn't allow religious liberty. I mean, come on, we're in the Western world in the 21st century. We love America. Why didn't they just let people believe as they ought to believe or wanted to believe? Well, in this case, the prophets of Baal had been leading God's people astray from the worship of Jehovah for more than 100 years. And so Elijah is standing up against that. And the Bible puts greater weight of guilt on the prophets who lead the people astray than the people themselves. He holds the prophets who know better responsible. And so this is the way Jesus addressed. He was always gentle in the New Testament with the common people who might be deceived and led astray. But how did he treat the Pharisees and the religious leaders? Boy, he looked them eyeball to eyeball, and he called them a generation of vipers. He called them whited sepulchers. And he did not hold back from the religious teachers who were leading people away from the truth. So Jesus' treatment in the New Testament is no different from Elijah's treatment in the Old. And there's another thing I think we need to remember here with religious intolerance. And I'm all for it. I'm grateful for America. Our world places a premium on human life, and that's a good thing. I still am grateful that there's a respect for human life. There's encroachments upon that, abortion and euthanasia and whatnot, but I'm glad it respects human life. But did you know that there's something more important than human life? I think we're ready for the next screen. It's the soul. This is what Jesus said in the New Testament, Matthew chapter 10, verse 28. Fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but fear him that which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. The worst thing that could happen to a person today is not that they would die physically. The worst thing that could happen to a person today is that they would die and their soul would go to hell for eternity. That's the worst thing. And so because the soul is so valuable, the God of the Bible is intolerant of those who lead his people astray, and the Jews were his people. There's only one way for a soul to get to God, and God's very clear about that. John chapter 14, verse 6, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Now, does that mean that we should be intolerant? Hey, the Bible is intolerant of false prophets. Should we be intolerant of false prophets today and the people who don't follow Jesus? I would say that we need to hold these two categories different. We need to be sharp and intolerant of people who are deliberately leading people astray. And there are people in religious circles who know better. And they're continuing their teaching because of the financial profit that it's bringing them, not because they're concerned about the souls of the men and women that they're leading. God is going to hold them to a greater accountability. Kind of shifting from lecturing over to preaching a little bit here, but you know, Jesus said, woe to them, Bethsaida, Chorazin, for if the works that had been done in you had been done in Sodom and Gomorrah, they would have repented a long time ago. And he went on to say, you will receive the greater condemnation. He uses a comparative word, and then he uses the word for condemning in the New Testament. Apparently, there are degrees of punishment, and that there are some going to be more highly punished on the other side. And I think false teachers are going to be at the top of that list, who are knowingly deceiving people away from God's truth. And I mean, that goes for the false prophets that stand up in religious garb, and that goes for the false prophets that stand up in our academic circles today and tell young people that there isn't a God, you don't need to believe the Bible, we've given up on all that bunk 50 years ago, don't be deceived. I'm talking about university professors and teachers in our high school who are trying to dismantle the faith of the few people in their class that still have it. I think they're going to receive a greater condemnation because of their words. Yeah, James says this, James chapter 3, verse 1, don't be many masters, knowing that ye shall receive the greater condemnation. James chapter 3, is it 3:1?
Yes.
I think it is. All right, so should we be intolerant of those who don't follow Christ? I think, again, we're dealing with categories. False teachers, yes, But the general people, we should have the attitude of the Apostle Paul, who in Romans chapter 10, here it is. Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved. Very patient and tolerant of the people outside our four walls who don't believe as we do. And we go to their door and they close it on us. We're still praying for them and earnestly seeking their salvation lest they be lost. Historically, Christians have been champions of religious freedom. Not always throughout history, but there have been times in history when Christians have been very much the champions, especially in this country, of religious liberty. Here's one man, Roger Williams. He left the Massachusetts Bay Colony because he wasn't worshiping and practicing the faith the way the Puritans wanted him to. And he felt he ought to be able to practice his faith the way he wanted to. So he left the Massachusetts Bay Colony, Puritan influence, started the colony of Rhode Island, still a state today, the smallest state. And it was started on the foundational principles of religious liberty. Virginia Baptist, later, led by Patrick Henry and others, were instrumental in getting the First Amendment to the Constitution added, which gives us, in the First Amendment, freedom of religion. Okay, I'm ready to move on. I want to talk about the third criticism. Hey, what about this Bible and capital punishment? That doesn't sound right. Did the Bible really support that you kill people if they don't do, you know, what society says or what the law says? And actually, it does, in several examples. If they worshipped other gods, Deuteronomy chapter 13, verses 6 and 10, said you were supposed to take them out and stone them. And that was Jewish execution at the time. But that's not the only thing. If someone practiced sorcery or witchcraft or the black arts, magic arts, they were to be executed. As is the case with those who are blaspheming. And the desecration of the Sabbath. A guy was gathering sticks. You might remember this from Numbers chapter 15. And Moses asked God, what do you want me to do with him? He's supposed to be executed. Those who refuse to listen to parents. Boy, this is sharp. Don't obey your parents. You know, this is interesting. This is what we do that's what they did with the kids in the Old Testament, right? They executed them if they wouldn't listen to their parents. Instead, today, we let them graduate from high school if they get that far. Then they get involved in crime. We lock them up in the prisons, and the rest of us pay to keep them alive for the rest of their lives behind bars. Hey, whether they did it this way or whether we do it this way, both understand that if you can't follow law and order in your own home, you're going to be a menace to the law and order of society, and something has to be done about it. You might think it's harsh. We've just opted in our society to treat it in a different way. Murder, Genesis chapter 9 and verse 6, and another verse on your outline, I think it's Numbers 23, says something about not allowing the murderer to live. 35:17. Adultery and immorality. If you were caught in that, that was also going to be involved execution, as well as kidnapping, stealing other people. Now, does the Bible really say that you're supposed to execute people for all these particular kinds of offenses? Yep. It's interesting, if you look at this list, almost without exception, it goes through the first eight commandments. Worshipping other gods, the first commandment says, what does it say, Andrew? First commandment. We're working on it at home. No gods before me, all right? The second commandment says, don't make unto you any graven image. Don't worship anything else. The third commandment is, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Fourth commandment, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Fifth commandment, honor your father and mother. Sixth commandment, don't kill. Seventh, don't commit adultery. And the eighth, thou shalt not steal, including another person. So why did God execute them want them to be executed for these crimes? Because they were breaking moral violations of His moral law, the Ten Commandments. He was very clear up front what He expected from them. So, in addition to that, in each of these particular crimes, the person poses a threat to the souls, not just of the perpetrator of the crime, but to anybody else who participates with him. The worshiping of other gods, he could lead other people astray and jeopardize their souls. And remember again, we're going back to what I mentioned earlier. What's more important than human life to God? Your soul and where it's going to be. So these crimes jeopardize the soul, both of the perpetrator and the participant. Sorcery and witchcraft would jeopardize the soul. Blaspheming God. The desecration of the Sabbath would take the souls of the people away from the fold of God. There's another reason, too, that these were capital offenses, and that's because the Jews were held to a higher standard than any other nation because they were being ruled in a theocracy, direct rule by God. And as a result, ultimately, they were going to be the nation through whom God was going to send the Messiah. So he had an earnest desire to keep the nation right so they wouldn't go away from God and be able to deliver the world to the world, the Messiah and the oracles of God, which we call the Old Testament today. And for those reasons, God held them to a higher standard. Now, is that what we should do today? Of course, our laws aren't written that way. Kidnapping, pretty serious offense, but probably not death. Certainly not death for this. Murder, yes. Maybe there'll be an execution on that after about 25 years of appeals and death row. So for most of these, we'd say that's not appropriate. So what should we do? Should we use capital punishment today? Is that what the Bible is teaching? And I would say no, except for one law. Before the Old Testament law was given to the nation of Israel and established them as a theocracy under Moses' leadership as a prophet, in Exodus chapter 20, only one of these offenses is mentioned as requiring capital punishment even before the law and before the nation of Israel was formed, and that would be the law against murder. Whoso sheds a man's blood, by his blood shall man his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. So I believe capital punishment endures beyond the law given to Israel because this law was actually instituted before the nation of Israel. You might come to a different conclusion about that, but yes, the Bible does support capital punishment. This is looked as a criticism against the Bible. Once you look at the Scriptures and how it's presented in the Scriptures, I don't think that that's really a legitimate criticism. And I think there are good reasons why it was in place. All right, let's go on to another hard question. Does the Bible permit or promote incest, as some allege? We have to deal with this question, where did Cain get his wife? Well, where did he get her?
Sister.
He had to marry his sister. There weren't any other options. If you believe the Bible genealogy, that it started with Adam and Eve, and from them were born children. Genesis 5:4 says, in the days of Adam after he had begot Seth, that's his third son, were 800 years, and he begat sons and daughters. How many children can you have in 800 years?
A lot.
So, and we've already dealt with the longevity of life in a previous lesson, so I don't have an issue with that at this point. But yeah,
how many kids could Eve have, though?
Yeah, that's
800 years.
Yeah, that's a good question too. I don't know.
She might have quit a while ago.
Yeah. The problem we have is because we read the present into the past when we look at this, and we have a problem with Cain marrying his sister. Such persons assume that such marriages would cause genetic deformities. And it does. If you have marriages between close relatives today, it does. But that's reading the present back into the past. That is a common evolutionary way of thinking. The way it is right now has to be the way it was 1,000 years ago, has to be the way it was 1,000,000 years ago. And as Christians, we don't believe that because we believe in a God who's allowed geologic catastrophism in the flood, and He has interjected throughout history in miracles, and so we don't believe in a static universe that is giving the same results at all points throughout history. That's an evolutionary assumption. And why that's important is because we believe, as Bible believers, that the genetic pool has deteriorated over time. And the genetic pool is getting worse, and the DNA is breaking down, which makes sense. Even the law of entropy, dealing with matter and energy, says that the universe is wearing down. We believe that. That's a law of science. I believe that's happening genetically. DNA is made up of nucleotides. Don't mean to be too technical with you, but it's a pairing of little parts to DNA on the ladder. And those ladders have to all line up. in order for the forming of a human life or any kind of life in the universe. And I think those nucleotides, over time, some of those begin to drop out. And if you have two people who are too closely related today, marrying, when the ladders match up, one from the male and one from the female, they're missing nucleotides that ends up allowing a genetic deformity to come out in the offspring. Well, assuming or believing that the genetic pool has deteriorated over time, at the beginning or right after Adam and Eve, there were no missing links in the DNA, and there would have not been this genetic deformity. However, shortly later, in the book of Leviticus, when the nation of Israel is established, laws go into effect that you can no longer be married to your sister or your mother or whatever. All these moral laws and civil laws are put into place for God's people. And so this came into being shortly after the flood, and incest gave way, and still to this day, I mean, even up until the 1880s, you could marry your first cousin. Now I think you still can, but you have to give some kind of a... Your parents have to agree or sign a contract, I think. Does anyone know?
Second cousin.
Is it your second cousin? Okay, 1880, I think maybe that was the year that you couldn't marry your first cousin anymore in our country. So while incest, again, is presented in the Bible, it is always presented in a negative light. I'll mention these couple of instances. Before the laws went into effect in the book of Leviticus and Exodus and Leviticus, we have examples of incest in the book of Genesis. Quickly, Genesis chapter 19 mentions Lot. He's fleeing the city with his wife. She gets turned into a pillar of salt. He goes and lives in a cave. We as Bible believers do believe in people dwelling in caves, but the Bible says they dwelt in cities first. When they fled the cities, then they dwelt in caves because they were running from something. So we do believe in cave people. Not quite the way that the evolutionary trail takes. But anyway, so he gets out there, and of course there is the two young ladies. What are we going to do? They've destroyed the city. There's no chance for us to get married. How are we going to... And so they end up getting their dad drunk on two consecutive nights, and both of them get pregnant by their dad. It's a dark chapter. I hate to even go there. You know, you just want to skip that when you're reading Genesis. You go... Is it 19 chapters later? It's Genesis 38, yeah. Double the chapter. Genesis 38, we read about Judah, whose first two sons had been married to the same girl, and they hadn't been able to produce offspring, and God struck them dead. You remember that? Onan, and I can't remember the second guy's name. So Tamar's waiting for the third son of Judah to come up. Shelah, I believe, is the name. And when Shelah comes up, he's not given to Tamar right away in the Levitical marriage that would have taken place to raise up seed to the brother who is deceased. So Tamar presents herself as a harlot. Judah goes into her. He's having incest. He doesn't even realize it. What a mess. That's a dark chapter. It's presented that way in Scripture. So in the incest is not endorsed by the Scripture, but people did originally marry their sisters. And this continued for several centuries till sometime after the flood. How about slavery? Oh, I already did all that. Slavery. It is taught in the Old Testament that when peoples conquered other peoples, that they made them slaves. This wasn't just true of Israel. All the nations did it. You conquered people, made them your slaves, and they increased your wealth because they could work for you, and you could go off and do military exploits and steal from other countries. This is the way it was for years. There's no Bible prohibition of slavery, and the Bible urges fair and humane treatment of every person, including slaves, and we see this in the New Testament and the Old. Exodus 12:49, one law shall be to him that is homeborn, and unto the stranger that sojourneth among you. You can't have two laws. You can't treat the slaves one way and yourself another way. Everybody's got to be treated the same way. In Colossians, masters were to give to the servants that which is just and equal, knowing that you also have a master in heaven. So, hey, the Bible was used to defend slavery in this country, but it was also used by the abolitionists like William Wilberforce to get rid of slavery. So it was used by both sides. So the Bible doesn't really take a side on the either in the Old Testament or the New Testament. It just does say treat slaves correctly. So what should you do? If you're a slave, according to 1 Corinthians, you're supposed to remain in your present condition and just serve God. If you're a slave, care not for it. Serve God. If you be free, use your liberty rather for the Lord. That's the Bible's attitude. You can look up those references later. They're in your outline. And then Colossians chapter 3 talks about obeying and respecting your master. The slave is not supposed to revolt, run from, hide from his master. He's supposed to obey and respect him. You got to understand that, that's right, in the year of Jubilee, the slaves were freed if they were Jews after 50 years. Actually, it was every 7 years. I'm sorry, it wasn't. The Jubilee is 50, but yes, after every 7 years, a Jewish slave could be freed, unless he wanted to be a slave for life. Here's the main point I want to give you about this. The Bible is more interested in your spiritual standing than your social standing. People have constantly been interested in social standing. In fact, there's a group of people that believe or teach that the main teaching of Jesus Christ isn't so much the gospel. He was teaching something called liberation theology. Any of you have heard liberation theology? It was about how to free peoples from oppression. That's what Jesus came to do. And it's been, that theology has been used to, you know, incite Latin American countries to independence and whatnot. But I don't believe that's why the Bible was written. Jesus didn't come to change your social position. He came to change your spiritual position with God. And that's why the Bible really doesn't take a position on slavery. In the first century, there were what? 6 million slaves in the Roman Empire? Was it 60 million slaves? I get the number mixed up. I don't know if it's a zero after it or not. A lot of slaves. And God said, don't fight it. Just do right in it. Let's get to the last question, because this is the one I've been wanting to get to. Genocide is a systematic, planned extermination of an entire national, racial, political, or ethnic group. In the last 100 years or so, we've had quite a bit of examples of this. The Armenian genocide of 1915 probably took somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 million people off the planet in that genocide. Hitler's Holocaust, of course, 6 million Jews. In addition, there were other political prisoners taken and executed with the Jews. But as far as extermination of one race, Hitler was trying to do that, obviously. The Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, 1975 to 79, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.7 to 2 million of Cambodia's elite. Rather than tolerate the people who are writing against the communist government, we'll just kill all the educated people that can write about it. And that's what the Khmer Rouge did. You might be more familiar with the Rwandan genocide in 1994 in our lifetimes, more recently. About 500,000 to 1 million people killed in the Rwandan genocide. In fact, somebody who was a medical assistant in my dental office a couple of months ago when I got my teeth worked on, she is the daughter of refugees from the Rwandan genocide. More recently, and still going on till today, is Darfur, Sudan. Probably in the neighborhood of 300,000 people executed, and more like 2 million people displaced. So we know a little bit about genocide. We've read about it, and we don't like it. So were the Jews commanded by God to do a similar thing? Oh, this is an itchy question. But I want to deal with the hard questions so that we have the answers that we need. This would be an easy one to kind of sidestep and avoid, because there's a lot of killing in the Old Testament. 50,000 died in this battle, and 25 in this, and 100,000 fell in one day. He's like, wow, this is a bunch of blood and gore in the Bible. All right. So what does the Bible really teach? Did the Jews commit genocide? There are many examples of battles with the Amalekites, the Midianites, the Canaanites, the Hittites. I don't have time to deal with all of them. So I'm going to take one particular group and use it as my test case. Now, when you do a test case, all the other cases may not line up exactly the same. I'm just trying to give you an answer for it, one example. And I hope that will serve when you run across the other examples that there are answers. I'm going to take the Midianites. It's in Numbers chapter 31. I'm going to refer to several references in that passage. Here are the facts. God says in the verse 2 of Numbers 31, "Avenge the children of Israel of the Midianites. Afterwards shalt thou be gathered unto thy people." So, Numbers chapter 31, verse 7 says, "And they warred against the Midianites as the Lord commanded Moses, and they slew all the males." All right? Here's the background of what's going on. Midian incited Israel to sin with Baal Peor, some kind of a false religious system or god that they set up. You might remember a character by the name of Balaam. He plays in here. He's mentioned in the book of Numbers, chapters 22 through 24. And he was hired by the Midianites to come curse Israel so that Israel wouldn't conquer them as a nation. And he was unable to do that. You remember, God foiled his plan, and every time Balaam spoke, he was blessing Israel instead of cursing them. You remember that. But he did apparently teach that if he could teach Balak, the king of Midian, he taught him if you get the people messed up in religious, false religion, then God will judge the people. That's the way to do it. Now, we're kind of reading between the lines because the scripture doesn't say that. But a few chapters later in Numbers, you know, Balaam shows up in 22 to 24. So we're dealing about seven chapters later, and we're finding God says it's time to go destroy the Midianites. All right? So the Midianites were inciting Israel to sin with Baal Peor. Only five Midianite cities were attacked. The virgin women were spared in the battle. This is verse number 9. "The children of Israel took all the women of Midianite captives and their little ones, and took the spoil of all their cattle and their flocks and all their goods. And these women weren't abused. Very likely they became servants or members of various families." 24 Israelites died before the battle ever took place because God broke out in wrath and sent a plague on his own people for being joined to Baal Peor, a false religious system. It's probably, and we're only guessing because the number isn't given, that there was probably a similar amount of Midianites that were killed. And only five Midianite cities were attacked. There were more, and we know this wasn't genocide because the Midianites appear later in the Old Testament. And they weren't exterminated as a race. It appears as if God targeted the particular cities that had incited Israel directly into the sin of Baal Peor. Now, I'm running through this a little bit quickly. You can read the text if you want more information in the outline, but hey, how does that treatment of the Midianites differ from 9/11? And I'm only using one example. I'm not taking time to go through the Canaanites or the Amalekites, other people that God told Israel to attack. For sake of time, just the Midianites. You see, this is a sticky problem for us. It was 14 years ago. In the name of Allah and Jihad, 19 hijackers flew planes into buildings or in the ground and killed almost 3,000 of our people. 2,977, I believe. If you count the hijackers, you're just like three shy of 3,000 people. What's that?
Plus those that are missing.
Are there still missing?
Yeah.
Presumed dead, apparently. All right. The figure I have is in my mind is 2,977. So does this differ? I mean, one religion runs airplanes into buildings. Another religion tells you to pick up a sword and kill everybody. What's the difference? Let me give you some differences. The souls of Israel were being directly threatened with acute spiritual danger by a false god. Remember, we've already talked about this several times. The soul of a person is more important than their human life. And to protect the souls of people, God sometimes asks that some lives be shed so in order to protect his people from acute spiritual danger and the loss of their souls eternally. God took justice first on his own people. God, the plague went out against those who got involved in Baal Peor, and 24,000 Israelites fell first. That's justice, because you're judging both ethnicities the same way for the sin. You're not holding one group different from the other. The Midianites struck first, harming Israel without pretense. Israel had not gone to their borders to fight them. They were only traveling through the area, and the Midianites struck first, harming Israel. In the case of 9/11, there was no warning of, you know, surrender, we're going to battle, be on the lookout, turn over these prisoners. Out of nowhere, the planes flew into the building. And this was not the way God treated the Midianites that Israel was fighting against. And mercy was shown whenever possible. The innocents, young kids and the women were spared, not the whole race being obliterated. Need to wrap this up. It's taken longer to get through than I anticipated. There is still some modern debate about an ethical thing that happened in August of 1945. Within 3 days of each other, two cities in Japan were bombed with the atomic bomb. Hiroshima, Nagasaki. Between the two cities, 220,000 people died or were incinerated. Well, I've used that word too much today, haven't I? I don't know why it just stuck today, but 220,000 people gone like that. But it is estimated that if American soldiers had made a land invasion of Japan, that it would have cost at least 1 million lives. I don't know who made the statistic, that's what the record says. And that probably as many people as died in those bombings or more, hundreds of thousands of both soldiers and Japanese civilians would have died in the land invasion of Japan. And so, in weighing that all out, Harry Truman and his advisors decided that in this case, it would be better to let a few die in order to save the many. People are still debating, to this day, the ethical nature. Was that the right thing to do? I think as long as history goes on, that'll be debated if that was the right thing to do. Why, if we as a people today, we can't decide whether killing a few or letting a whole bunch more die and how to... Why if we can't figure that out ethically, why are we going to be so quick to point the finger at God and say, God, you blew it, the Bible, I don't like that, that's genocide, when we can't even decide? I mean, if you had a room of 100 people in here or 200 people and you asked them, all those in favor of the bombings on this side and all those who thought it was the wrong decision for the American government to make on this side, and you'd have the room just split about just down the middle, I would imagine. So certainly we must be careful pointing fingers at God when mankind itself has found it justifiable at times to kill some to save many others. Another thing we could throw in here quickly is this. Those who are often quick to point fingers at God for allowing genocide or allowing something that looks like genocide in the Old Testament, killing of Amalekites or Midianites or Canaanites, what have you, these are the same ones who get up and defend the murder of innocent unborn children year after year in our country that now totals more than 45 million. 45 million. Did you hear that? 45 million unborn innocents since 1973. Conclusion. When somebody acts that way and says that God's at fault or the Bible's at fault, there is a subtle attitude of pride here that I know better than God and we're smarter than God and we're in the 21st century and how God could have ever let that happen. That's a pride thing. Whether or not they see it, they think themselves wiser and better than God. But in the end, the world doesn't answer to any man or woman. It answers to God, and the judge of all the earth will do right. And in the end, all of his actions will be vindicated as just and right and good. So let God be true, Paul says, and let every man be a liar. All right, we've finished five evidences now. Are we still willing to brush all this evidence aside that would suggest that the Bible has an answer? And that was the point tonight. Not whether or not you agree with the answers, but there is an answer to these heavy questions. And if there is an answer to the questions, then we can't just be quick to dismiss the Bible. But some still do. And if you are dismissing the Bible still as being untenable, unbelievable, is that really because the facts are on your side, or are you just prejudiced, or do you have a principle to base it on? And the second, are you honestly open, hey, if the Bible is true, that you would do what it says and read it and follow it? Next week, Lord willing, we're going to tackle hey, if this Bible really isn't true, then what's the whole point of it? Why are there so many genealogies and histories and people and nations and instructions? Sometimes we get lost in all the little bit of clutter. You get in the middle of the forest and all you can see are the twigs and the sticks and the leaves. And we want to back away and we want to look at the whole theme and message. We want to look at the whole forest, if we can, next week, figure out why the Bible is here. All right. Thank you for your time. There are some additional criticisms listed in the appendix, and I hope those will be a help to you. I'm going to go ahead.